UK Motor Talk.
Hello everyone, and welcome along to the 199th UK Motor Talk podcast. I'm Mike, hello.
I'm Graham, hello.
And how are we? Apart from damp, I think is pretty much the number, isn't it really?
Yeah, I mean, with the feet immersed permanently in several inches of water, it's hardly a surprise if the feet start to develop strange webbing between the toes.
Well, Saturday I decided to clean the Mini for the first time in a while. And it's clear that it's been neglected over winter. It's been miserable weather. And when it has been good weather, I've tended to do things with the family. So I'm starting to get that awkward sort of green build-up around the sunroof channels and all that kind of stuff that you really... It sounds a lot worse than perhaps it was, but it really did need a good clean. And I washed it because it was sunny and then it rained. So I dried it. Then I polished it. Then it rained. So I dried it before I waxed it. Then it rained and I waxed it. Slicked the tyres, and then it hailed. It's almost like I was being punished every single step. Every time I did anything to it, it was like, no, you won't, you're not going to do this. You're doing the rain dance, stop it. And then, yeah, it just absolutely came down with hail. And my oldest was with me in the car, and because he'd been climbing through, taking his shoes off, and was just climbing around inside the car, playing with the buttons and stuff as kids like to do. And we just ended up having to just grab him and then run inside with him. So it was absolutely coming down with hail. So goodness knows what the weather's doing. It wants to hurry up and cheer up, really, because this is spring now. We should be out there enjoying it. But I did manage, as a result of getting it all clean and getting it all sorted, to get to the first show of the season and managed to get the Mini out with the family up to Brooklands, which was quite nice. Well, it does seem to have developed. When I stopped, it had this very weird misfire that hasn't come back again. But you always get a bit worried when that happens, don't you? Why has it only happened under certain circumstances? What thing has gone on there? But it is 21 years old, so I guess it has the right to be a bit grumpy from time to time.
Was the Mini gathering at Brooklands a classic this year? I know you're a regular attendee. Was it good?
It was excellent, as it often is. The weather always helped. It was freezing cold. But otherwise, yeah, it was a really good day. There's a good mix now of classics and more modern Minis. And I think that we've got to the point where my old girl, which is the first of the BMW lot, are becoming fewer in number, becoming more accepted by the owners of the classics, particularly if they still get used and driven all the time. Because they're getting quite expensive to run now, and obviously getting that bit older and slightly more temperamental, as I've mentioned. But it's a great show. You know, you've got traders. Brooklands is just a fantastic environment anyway. And if you go with the kids, as often the case now, a part of the fun of doing the shows is that I take the family, and there's a lot to see at Brooklands. If you've not been before, and I know that obviously you have many times, Graham, but if you're listening now and haven't been to Brooklands, you're thinking about it. There's a good museum, several different types of museums, actually. So if you're interested in cars or planes, one of my favourite things over the weekend, and there's a photo of me looking much like a kid in a sweet shop or something. I was absolute glee of sitting in the cockpit of a Harrier and having a look through all the controls. It's like, that's cool, isn't it? Who doesn't want to sit in the cockpit of a Harrier? So you've got all that going on. And there's quite a lot of interactive aspects for the kids now as well. So in the plane shop, you can build a small aluminium plane. You can learn about the process of bending the metal, about shaping propellers, about riveting, all that kind of stuff, which is riveting. we all really enjoyed it. So I went with my oldest Austin and my dad as well. And we could do that, enjoy seeing the Minis, but also go and enjoy Brooklands generally. And similar sort of thing if you get to do one of the Simply Days at Bewley. And I'll be heading along in a couple of months' time to go and do one of those. You get to drive in, you get to park actually in the Bewley grounds, and the cars are on display. Handy if you've taken a picnic or something with you, of course, as well, because it's always there. You don't have to hike to the car park to go and get it. But by the same token, you can experience everything that the museum has to offer, and Little Bentley, and which is like a big play park area, like a treetop play park area, and then also the house and grounds as well. So there's a bit more than just the cars there. So you don't not necessarily getting the kids to come along and look at all of them whilst you stand there and chat to the owners. You actually go and enjoy a bit of everything. So there's a lot to be said, I think, for these more sociable types of shows.
Yeah, I agree.
And same if you get the opportunity to display or take part in local fetes and fairs and things like Rotary Club events, which I do a few of now, where you're actually part of the whole thing, but you also get to go and take part in various different stalls and activities, and sometimes have, you know, a food area, and you've got all kinds of street foods and stuff. So there's a lot more around the scene now than there used to be. it was very difficult to try and explain to begin that I enjoy spending my time parked in car parks talking to other people that drive the same car that I do about the car that they're driving that I also drive, which sounds very weird when you try and explain it, doesn't it?
Those two museums have very sensibly in the last, well, the last 5 to 10 years have moved on considerably and have gone from being a sort of den of iniquity for one make anoraks to genuine family days out. And, you know, there's a lot more interactive stuff and taking their steer from the, you know, the big museums in London and so on. They're much more family orientated now than was previously the case. And I think Brooklands is a very good example of that. There's a lot more stuff for the kids to do. And, you know, if you can walk through Concord and take a ride on a double decker bus and all that stuff that, unless you're a silly old beggar like me, you won't have done. Well, I never got invited to Concord, but there you go. I took my grandson and he absolutely loved it because he'd only ever seen them in pictures, and suddenly you can walk through Concord.
The kids just like getting on off the planes. You could spend all day just getting on off the planes or going around the London Bus Museum. It's really interesting. And I think it's, as you say, being able to open up a bit more to these type of family days where they play the role of host. Because once you're in, aren't you? And usually you get a discounted ticket if you take one of the cars in. It doesn't really matter what you drive. If you look at the events at Brooklands and Beauty through the year, you'll probably find something that if you have a interest or an interest in cars, you'll probably be able to go and park in. If you go to a Ford day, if you've got a Ford, it doesn't necessarily need to be a sporty Ford. It can just be a Ford. Then you could do that and park in general parking if you really wanted to. Or again, a Mini. Or there was, I think one of the interesting ones, there was a James Bond day at Bewley. And you think, oh, that you have to turn up an Aston Martin or something, but it was any car that's been in a James Bond film. So that could be a 2CV or a BMW 7 Series or a Z3 or whatever it might be. Admittedly, if you're going to have to buy one to go, that's an expensive ticket to entry to get a few quid off and for the convenience of parking right inside. But well, let's face it, if you wanted to do that at Goodwood, you have to get a supercar or something similar and pay 75 quid for the privilege. So maybe it's better value than that, I don't know. Actually, if you wanted to get into James Bond car ownership, one such option is a Volvo S40, average price, £2,500, as seen in Quantum of Solace. Although I reckon you could probably get a Z3 for cheaper than that now. That's probably going to be the cheapest sporty Bond car, I reckon, a Z3. I've did a few of those sub £2,000. I mean, I imagine they're an absolute pile, but it's got to be a potential, isn't it?
I think your maintenance bill is going to be an awful lot higher than it would for the S40. Because they were pretty rugged.
And let's not forget the first of the Daniel Craig cars as well. So Ford went through a little stage of trying to advertise and everything. I mean, they ruined Thunderbirds by doing that, in fact, Thunderbirds movie, because everything was sponsored by Ford, the new sponsored by Ford and everything else. But they did put Bond, I'm pretty sure it was Daniel Craig's first movie, in a Mondeo Titanium or Mondeo Gear or something. It was the very first of the four Mondeos. And I remember there's been some glamour shots of going spinning around the car. So there you go. That's another option for you. Mark IV Mondeo. Also a Bond car. Technically, because he drove it. It wasn't just in the Bond film. He did drive it. It's a Renault 19, maybe? I'm sure he drove a Renault 19 at some point.
Yeah, that's quite possible.
Was it Renault 9? I can't remember now.
I remember meeting and interviewing, years and years and years ago, the chap that had built himself a very nice career at Ford of just placing cars in TV series and in films. And, fascinating individual. His name completely escapes me. But he'd started off by persuading Ford to lend the cars for Zed cars. And if you're very, very long in the tooth, you might remember that. But Sweeney and, you know, all of those things that involved Fords. This was one man's passion to get Fords into TV and the movies. And he was very, very good at it.
It worked.
And
it absolutely worked.
The last ones I think he placed were in the movie that that you referred to.
Thunderbirds.
Because I actually drove a couple of the cars from that movie on a sort of Ford press day, playing my role as Parker. but I don't have the accent and they couldn't find a hat big enough for me.
Have you done anything exciting in the automotive world?
I replaced the rear wiper on the Volvo. That was entertaining.
Sweet, sweet, sweet wiper blade swapping out there.
Well, I've noticed the entire motor had gone, which a bit of a surprise, but there you go. I guess they don't last forever.
You say that, but at the Practical Classics over the weekend, I saw that someone had posted up a, a Volvo 240 that done something like 858,000 miles. That's pretty exceptional, isn't it?
Yeah, it's curious that all of the sort of really, really high mileage vehicles do seem to be Volvos.
Mm.
They seem to last an awful long time, except when I own them and then they don't, but there you go.
I think it's just you.
Yeah, perhaps so.
What must you do to be able to kill a Volvo? That's pretty... In fact, if you've got an answer to this, let us know. Write to us or tell us. We are at UK Motor Talk pretty much everywhere. What have you managed to do to kill a Volvo? I think they're pretty much unkillable, really.
I remember seeing some years ago a Volvo estate that the family had managed to climb out of when somebody had actually parked a tractor on the roof. It had fallen off a truck alongside them and landed right way up on the roof of the Volvo, and they got out unscathed.
That's pretty incredible. I've seen one drop from some height on its roof, actually, and it still seemed to hold pretty well. I know Volvo have always been very safety conscious, but this wasn't a new one. This was some years ago. And the fact that it was able to hold up to it, and they even test, I think it's the elk test that they do, where they, moose test, where they fire one over the bonnet, basically, and make sure that the A-pillars don't crumple. Quite impressive. Really quite impressive.
Yes, I remember the story of which American president was it? Ronnie Reagan, I think it was, being shown around Boeing, the flavour of the month they are too. One of their tests on the windscreens of the I think it was the 747s, was they would fire chickens at it.
Yes, they do it for the engines.
Well, one apparently went straight through because they'd run out of chickens, and somebody had substituted a frozen one, which went straight through the screen. Nearly took out Ronnie Reagan, but there you go.
I can imagine that being an issue. Yeah, they did that for the engine testing as well, don't they? Fire turkeys and things through the engines to try and make sure they'll be okay. But certainly, I think if they fire one at Volvo will just take it out. There's no question, is there, really? Perhaps the only thing that could traverse our potholed, pockmarked, bombed-out roads, I suspect, at the moment. Because driving around the last few weeks, they have been, well, dreadful.
The situation is getting worse and worse with more and more neglect by local authorities. And, you know, it's not that my local authority is any worse than any other. Or perhaps it is a little bit worse. It's equally strapped for cash as most of them are these days, and starved of central government funding. And it's certainly not going to get any better in the short term. Much was made on the news in the last few days of, I think it's $14 billion to repair all the potholes. I can't quite see how that figure was plucked together, but I was reminded of a fellow broadcaster, a somewhat older gentleman than me, when anybody came up with a survey like that. His first response would be, who says? Quite rightly so, in this instance, it was the Asphalt Manufacturers Association. So, no, they didn't stand to gain very much by quoting 14 billion quid for repairs.
I've hit one so big once that the car practically bottomed out. It was something in the order of about 4 inches deep, and it was huge and full of water, and also completely unavoidable, which was really irritating. If there's any consolation, by the way, road tax or road fund licence, I appreciate they don't spend a lot of it on the actual roads these days. It's a percentage of it, but that generated 7.2 billion between 2022-2023. And VAT, I was looking at yesterday because I was interested to know how much money we spend and then re-spend on things that qualify for VAT, managed to raise about 162 billion. So you think that hopefully there'd be a bit of money in there to do something about fixing the roads. Although, obviously, we spend a lot of money on fixing and maintaining people as we do anything else, I guess. Perhaps that's where it all goes.
There's a disproportionate split between what comes out to local authorities for local roads and what the Highways Agency takes for the maintenance of A roads and the motorway network and so on and so on. And most motorways are in fairly good shape. But you get into a lot of A roads and certainly B roads, and anything that hasn't got a letter preceding it is just, it's worse than when the Romans left it. Clearly the Romans are rather better road builders than we are, because they were marching their forces up and down. They kept things in rather a better order. So if anybody asks what the Romans did for us, they taught us how to build roads and then we seem to have forgotten how to do so.
I've seen some Roman roads recently. Actually, it's just literally below the surface of the roads which have broken up. They've seemed to have made their way all the way back down to that that layer through the substrate and down to the Roman roads. But there's been some pretty horrific ones. Jim and I were over Kent Way today, disappearing off down towards an industrial area down near the ports on the side of the Medway. And there were a few relatively chunky holes in the road. Probably been big enough to bury a ship in, let alone bury a car in. But there you go.
Local road near me, only 2 or 3 days ago, complete wheel, tyre, front assembly just ripped off. Curiously, you know, the roads across the nation are littered with discs off steel wheels. And this complete wheel sub-assembly, the wheel trim was still in place.
Good effort.
The gouging of the tarmac clearly... A pretty substantial accident had ensued, and somebody must have got a hell of a fright, but it was a big pothole. I mean, there are people who spend their spare time investigating caves and really enjoy doing so, and the rest of us investigate potholes, which are nearly as big as caves. There are things like Cheddar Gorge littering every sea road in the country. Why the hell can't we get our roads properly sorted when most countries in Europe manage to do so?
We do seem to really suffer. I don't know if it's just a result of the weather and conditions, whether it's a result of red tape and nonsense, but I remember damaging my car and trying to get something sensible out of the council, and they decided after months of bouncing it around that they weren't responsible for it for whatever reason. Months and months of bouncing around. Well, who is then?
They'll always put you off.
Yeah, you know.
Where you see the holes marked with white paint or whatever, there's a very good reason for that. Is because in the event of an incident, they can then claim on their insurers. Because the first question, because I've filled these in the past, the first question the insurers will ask is this hole, road, whatever, part of a maintenance program? And generally speaking, the local authorities' insurers will pay up if it is. So they won't need to do anything about it other than, in all honesty, they can say, oh, yes, it's part of a maintenance program. We've been out there and marked it as such. So if they put up a couple of cones or put some white paint around it, that means that their insurers have to cough up. It doesn't mean to say they're necessarily going to share it with you. And I hear very, very few stories of people who've made successful claims against local authorities.
Well, I think their question was, has it been reported? Because if it's been reported, they've then got a responsibility for it. If they haven't, it's just tough luck. And if it has been reported, they've then got so long to fix it or paint a box around it or do whatever they want to do with it. But the road, I say, it was so deep, the pothole. I think it was near enough 4 inches deep, but it was certainly a full 2 wheels wide. It was huge. It was actually massive. Massive pothole, and so full of water, and so A, you couldn't see it, and B, just completely unavoidable. But there you go, who knows? It seems round our way, the big issue has been drainage. They've done a lot of building, a lot of it on floodplains, and they don't seem to be particularly interested in maintaining the guttering or the drains or anything else. So a lot of the roads end up getting flooded, then the surfaces get damaged. There's nowhere for the water to soak away anymore, and so it sits around for a long period of time. And then you go through deep water, hit a massive pothole, and that's it, blows a tyre out. And we've had quite a few recently that have come through at work that have had exactly that.
I lost the oil seal off the Volvo steering rack not so very long ago. That cost me quite a lot of money. And I was quite convinced, and so with the garage, that that was down to a pothole. Again, in that scenario where it's dark, it's full of water, and you can't see it. You know, you haven't got a hope in hell.
Sometimes it's just unavoidable, isn't it? What would you rather do? Hit the oncoming traffic or thunder down a pothole? It doesn't matter. You can stand on the brakes, I suppose, and hope the person behind you doesn't go at the back of you. But you can't always drop from 20, 30 miles an hour to zero quick enough to avoid it.
Yeah, indeed.
What is interesting is they're building a new bypass not too far away from where I am. And I was driving up the road to go through it, and it flooded completely across. And there was a guy at the side waving us through. And it was pretty deep. And everyone was going through relatively carefully. You always get some idiot that goes through and creates a massive wave that drowns everyone else's cars out. But I was driving an electric car, and I was thinking about this and thought, well, actually, the batteries and motors and everything are sealed. There's nothing really to intake to cause much of a problem here. So you can just drive through. You could wade through, presumably, up until the door seals give up, or the water gets high enough that it comes through the heater or something like that.
I wouldn't want to test it.
Yeah, well, it's only 480 volts. What's there to be afraid of? One thing I did notice earlier on today, I keep an eye on lease deals just because sometimes something crazy comes up where a manufacturer wants to get rid of something very quickly, and they'll have a huge stockpile of something, presumably because they have to either register them by a certain point, or they've got some vanity over numbers they want to hit, so they're trying to sort fleet targets out. But due to a bit of a softening in interest of electric stuff, it seems that there's some very good Lee Steels. I say there's a softening of interest. There's a combination of factors. I know we've all mentioned before: cost of public charging, availability of charging, usually public charging, the general anti-EV sentiment that's been flying around, a lot of it generated by ignorance in truth, but there's some valid points as well, of course, and we've obviously spoken about that before.
There's definitely is some evidence softening in the market.
There is, but there's also a huge pressure still from the UK government, this is a UK thing,
sure,
to register 22% of EVs this year, of whatever the manufacturer produces, or face a fine of £15,000 a car, which is obviously chunky. So they're going, right, we need to register some EVs. The market is saying, well, we don't want to pay a premium for having to drive something electric, particularly if it's going to cost us near enough as much to run, if the energy's not so good. If you can charge at home, then you're laughing. If you can't, then, well, if you're filling up at a motorway service station, it costs pretty much the same as filling up a motorway service station, for example. And the government's got higher rates of VAT on public charging, does at home charging. So there's lots of disadvantages if you don't have someone to charge it. Nevertheless, if you do, there's some absolutely cracking deals out there. So if you are looking for a new car and you want something family sized and something that's either a little bit different or more powerful or relatively interesting, the Ioniq 5, good car as we know. These are generally just, they give you an example of 6,000 miles, but obviously you can add a few more, it adds a few more quid. It's usually not a huge amount, actually. To add a few thousand miles usually adds a tenner, maybe 20 quid a month. It's not a lot. But Ioniq 5, really good EV. Initial payment of £1,250, 23 monthly payments of £299.29. That seems pretty good to me. Obviously, you put a bigger payment up front in, then it makes it cheaper per month.
That's a good car for that money.
Yeah, it's a good car for that money. The new Honda NE1, why don't I just call it the NE1, which I've not driven, but nevertheless, I've seen some ridiculous deals on that. £179 down, £179 a month, which is just madness.
I didn't see that I didn't foresee that anybody was going to come in under the 200 a month sort of barrier.
There's just some very, very good deals. Lexus RZ. So this is a premium car, 450e. 230 kilowatts, 71.4 kilowatt hour battery, 24 month term. If you want to put down £2,700, £300 a month. So that's a premium car at that money.
Cheap deal.
I know it's an amount of money, but to put that in perspective, if you were putting that money into a normal petrol car, then you'd probably be paying £350, I suppose, a month for an average car. And going back a few months, if you were looking to buy an EV, you were probably putting in a fair chunk more. I think sort of something like a Mach-E was about £7,000 down and 500 and something a month going back a few months. So it gives you an example of as to how affordable these suddenly become as the manufacturers become more desperate to shift them. So it might be worth just having a look. And the beauty, of course, if you are leasing something, is at the end of it, you give it back. So if the market has completely dropped out or cars have suddenly become a lot more efficient, then you've got options. Same with the PCP, of course, but it is relatively risk-free. You don't gain anything from it. But of course, at that sort of money, it seems like certainly worth having a look, if nothing else.
It does seem sort of an element of desperation, I think, a little bit in the market. It seems to reflect a number of factors. I think the early adopters have all had their fill. The fleets have taken an awful lot of EVs and can't keep taking as many as they have been. And the government extending the deadline on hybrids has caused, I think, a lot of people to sort of rethink their position. And, you know, well, maybe we'll carry on for another 5 years with that horrible oil burner and dip into the EVs when they're a bit more affordable and a bit more reliable and a bit more this and a bit more that. I mean, this is not my thinking. I think I'm expressing what is probably a fairly common view.
Recently, I attended a meeting where I've looked at the registration figures actually for last year, and diesel's dropped off a cliff, that's disappeared. Petrol hybrid has increased, and I think as there are more and more incentives to do so, more people will probably do it. The Subaru Solterra, if you want to call it the Sultana, which is the same as the Toyota BZ4X or whatever alphabet spaghetti they've called it. I saw a deal for one of those as well. Again, a couple of grand in, so just over £2,000 in, £225 a month. suddenly that becomes a very cheap car. It becomes a family-sized car for very small car money, which is interesting. It is interesting. So I think there are deals to be had out there, and it's worth having a look, would be my thoughts on that. Some useful consumer advice there from UK Motor Talk this week.
We've got the Goodwood events coming up shortly, and one of the features of Goodwood, of course, is the fact that the track and most of the buildings are original and so on and so on. And they've just been persuaded to buy Ken Tyrrell's shed, which I just think is brilliant. I mean, I interviewed Ken down there many, many years ago, and it was just a big shed. But, you know, they were building Formula One World Championship cars in there, and when you look at the facilities that the modern day F1 teams have got. But yeah, I'm really glad, well done Goodwood, for having the sense to buy it and erect it, and it will be able to be seen at the next Goodwood event members meeting.
I was really excited to see this because I spotted this on their Facebook feed, I think it was, as well, that they'd rescued the shed, which was in danger of basically tumbling down, and they've taken it, they've built it up. And it looks completely at home with Goodwood. It looks absolutely in the right
perfect.
Place.
Perfect. It's perfect.
And a lot of the original labels and markings, they're inside the shed, are still there. So you can see where they've had something like a pipe clamp or something hanging up on the pipe slice, or I don't know what it was, but hanging up on the wall where they've drawn round it. And you can see the stickers on the side of the walls. They've got some of their Land Rovers parked in there at the minute. Mm. But I do really want to have a proper nosy round. It really could do with being a small museum, couldn't it, with a couple of Tyrrells in there. I think that would be a wonderful thing to go and see. And I'm very pleased that even though it's in inverted commas just a shed, that it's been saved, because it is a really important piece of history. So yeah, well done Goodwood for that.
Ken was an absolute gentleman of an old school, and one of my first big interviews I did was with Ken Tyrrell, and I was using a new piece of BBC kit, made a complete bollocks of it, and it didn't record. And it, you know, he was very nice to give me the interview anyway. And I sort of rather humbly crawled back and kissed his boots and said, Ken, you know, I made a mess of it. Can we do it again? Yeah, of course. Not a problem. Let's step outside. It's too noisy in here. And I interviewed him for, it's been 15 to 20 minutes. Absolute brilliant. Real gent.
They don't make him like that anymore. There is one thing I did want to talk about, and that is Valtteri Bottas has done an amazing advert in Australia for Uber car share. And if you've not seen this, it's worth a Google, because I think it is genuinely hilarious.
Very funny.
And considering how should I say, hammy some of the F1 drivers acting, let's not necessarily their skill set, let's face it. This is genuinely funny, genuinely amusing, and it is excellent, isn't it? And he seems to be living his best life.
Yeah, although he's near the back of the grid, but it doesn't seem to be perturbing him too much. And no doubt he got paid an awful lot of money for the advert, but you've interviewed him, I've interviewed him. He's not a man who seems to take himself quite as seriously as some of the sort of F1 prima donnas do. And, I mean, you know, he's basically this advert. He's a big joke on himself. He's taking the mickey out of himself all the way through it. And
yeah.
I did like the bit where he's demonstrating its ability to get rid of insects, and it sort of sprays him with something very unpleasant. Cough, cough, splutter, splutter. It's very funny, yeah, as you say.
It's just a brilliant pause, isn't there? You know, and with the mullet and the tash and everything else that goes with it. You got the impression, I got the impression interviewing them, he's just a guy, like a lot of racing drivers are. They're guys that are exceptionally good at what they're doing, very focused and obviously very trained in talking to the press. But we sat there, and I think my first question to him, or one of my first questions was, ask him about the M&M concert he'd been to the night before. And it was nice just to have a chat about stuff that wasn't car related. And as you say, it's clear that he doesn't necessarily take himself too seriously, although he has quite a steely gaze, isn't he? He's looking at you, he's very serious. And you got the feeling that he was quite bored of answering the same questions. I think he was quite pleased to talk about something else. But to watch him tuck into a hot pie and just do this sort of parody on stereotypes, I think it was really amusing. So that's definitely something else that you should check out today. Worth having a look at that. Whether you're likely to travel to Australia and use this service, I suspect probably not. However, it really was quite a good watch.
Yeah, when you're talking to him, he has that sort of blue-eyed Nordic stare, which, you know, just sort of makes you wonder if you're heading for trouble, whatever you ask him. But he is, I found him, and I know you did, just genuinely a bit of fun to interview, and just didn't take himself too seriously. This is evidence of that. There are some others on the grid who Gasly is one that springs to mind, and George Russell. You know, they're not quite as pompous about it as some of the drivers are. There's a certain very successful winning driver at the moment, I think, has got pomposity mastered. But there you go. That's just my opinion. What do I know?
You could imagine Danny Ric doing something like this, couldn't you? But Bottas is probably not the one you would have expected.
Yeah, indeed so.
It is just amusing. But that really did get me enough to be able to sort of screen grab that just to share it with you guys. I thought it was one of the funniest things I've actually seen this week. I really did enjoy that. And I guess on that note, it must be time to end. So I'd like to say thank you very much to listening to Graham and I at Whistler On. Drive safe, watch out for potholes, and have a look at the exciting stuff that's out there. So I've been Mike, goodbye.
And I'm Graham. Goodbye and take care of yourselves. Bye-bye now.
UK Motor Talk, a First Take Media production.